another bloody day in the occupied West Bank. The Israeli military attacks Jenin refugee camp. South Korea imposes unilateral sanctions on the North in response to its latest ballistic missile tests. Plus, a new report says U.S. inflation increased in September over a surge in rents and higher costs of food and medical care. Hello and welcome. Your world news coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi.
It's been another day of attack, gunfire and bloodshed in the occupied West Bank. Israeli forces have a raid at the Flashpoint refugee camp in Jenin. There have been multiple casualties. A young Palestinian man identified as Matin Sabaya was killed during the raid. Also, Abdullah Aboutin, a Palestinian doctor who was helping the wounded, has been shot. He is currently in critical condition and undergoing surgery. At least 8 people were also wounded during the raid. Meanwhile, Mohammad Maher Turkman, the Palestinian who carried out an operation injuring 7 Israeli soldiers in September, has succumbed to his wounds. Israel has intensified its deadly crackdown against Palestinians in the occupied territories over the past months. More than 100 Palestinians have been killed this year so far. For more details, we're joined by our correspondent Mona Kendall. Mona, tell us more about this recent raid on the Jenin refugee camp.
20-year-old Matin Dababa, this Palestinian young man, was shot dead in the Jenin refugee camp during an Israeli military raid to Jenin and its refugee camp. As you have mentioned, one Palestinian doctor was also wounded and he's sustaining serious injuries during this operation. And we are speaking about 8 more Palestinians were wounded during this operation. The doctor is in serious condition, according to what we have received, and he is under surgeries up till the moment. The Israeli forces said the operation is meant to arrest Palestinians wanted for security reasons. As we are speaking now, we're receiving that hundreds of Palestinians are taking part in the funeral procession of the young man Matin Dababa in the Jenin refugee camp, and the operation is still going on. All the entrances to Nablus city, that is the first city while on the way to Jenin, is completely closed. All military checkpoints are closed there. Palestinians are not allowed to enter Nablus and Jenin areas. We have to mention that this is happening in the last few days in search for a Palestinian who carried out a shooting operation on Tuesday, and the Israeli forces are still searching for this Palestinian man whom killed an Israeli soldier near an illegal settlement near Nablus. As you have also said, a young Palestinian, teenager, 17-year-old Mohammed Turkman, a Palestinian prisoner, actually, he was wounded during an operation last month in the Jordan Valley. And today, the Israeli prison authorities declared that Mohammed Turkman succumbed to his injuries, and he's from the Jenin area.
Thank you very much. That was our correspondent, Mona Kendall, live from Ramallah. Moving on, North Korea test fires yet another missile in the situation on the North Korean peninsula as the situation on the Korean peninsula enters new highs. According to a South Korean news agency, Pyongyang launched a short-range ballistic missile into the sea and flew nearly a dozen fighter jets close to the border with the South. The North Korean military has described its latest actions as strong countermeasures to Seoul's provocative artillery fire near the border. It also accuses the South of inciting tensions with its reckless actions. Seoul has reacted angrily to the latest test, urging its northern neighbor to refrain from creating military tensions.
North Korea's artillery fire and short-range ballistic missile launch in the buffer zone of the East and West Sea are serious provocations that undermine peace and stability on the Korean Peninsula as well as the international community. Our military warns North Korea against continuing provocations causing military tensions on the Korean Peninsula and strongly urges it to stop them immediately.
Seoul has also imposed its first unilateral sanctions against the North in nearly 5 years. It has blacklisted North Korean individuals and institutions involved in missile development. Pyongyang has carried out several missile tests over the past 2 weeks that were overseen by the country's leader, Kim Jong-un. The North says its tests are necessary and a response to joint military drills by the South, the United States, and Japan. Pyongyang considers the war games as a rehearsal for an invasion. We asked our correspondent in Seoul, Jennifer Chang, about how each side has been responding to the escalating tensions, and here's her account.
South Korea and the U.S. continue to stage drills against North Korea. Yesterday, for instance, at Chalwon in South Korea near the inter-Korean border, the two allies staged MLRS drills. And these multiple launcher rocket systems are seen as a grave threat by North Korea because the two allies have reinstated their annual drills in which they practice assassinating North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and wiping out all nuclear and missile facilities in the north. So North Korea responded by sending its warplanes, 10 warplanes, to the inter-Korean border. This is highly rare. So right now, tensions are really getting out of control. And afterward, the North also fired a short-range ballistic missile into the sea. And this flew 700 kilometers. So this was seen as a major threat. Of course, when the North Koreans scrambled the warplanes, the South Koreans also scrambled their own fighter jets to the inner Korean border. So a possibility of an accidental clash is growing daily.
More bad news for the U.S. economy. The official data shows that the country's inflation jumped more than expected in September despite an aggressive central bank policy. According to the Labor Department statistics, prices rose 0.4% in September compared to the previous month. It says the impact was largely on food, shelter, and medical care. The report comes before midterm elections in which Republicans have sought to blame President Joe Biden's administration for the crisis. It also raises concerns that the Federal Reserve will extend its policy of supersized interest rates to counter inflation. Last month, the Fed increased the rate for the third time to bring down inflation, which peaked at nearly 40-year high in June. The Treasury Secretary and other officials have defended their economic policies. They attribute price rises to supply chain problems and other unforeseen events, including the war in Ukraine. The epidemic of gun violence in the United States is taking more lives. 5 people have been shot dead in the state of North Carolina. The shooting took place on Thursday in the Capitol. An off-duty police officer is among the victims as well. The incident left 2 other people wounded, with one of them said to be in critical condition. Following the shooting, police started a massive manhunt and urged citizens to the neighborhood, to remain indoors. They say the juvenile suspect is now in custody. No more details are available about the suspect. The governor of North Carolina has reacted to the worrisome acts of gun violence in America.
Tonight, terror has reached our doorstep. The nightmare of every community has come to Raleigh. This is a senseless, horrific, and infuriating act of violence.
The mayor of the capital has also called for measures to stop what she calls mindless violence in America. A total of nearly 49,000 people lost their lives due to gun-related injuries of all causes last year. Similar incidents in the past have prompted widespread calls for tighter gun control laws, but to no avail. International lawyer Barry Grossman believes that bias legislation and social injustice lie at the root of gun violence in America.
That the problem in the United States is less about guns and even shooting than it is about the disenfranchisement of vast swaths of the population. Biased laws which are also unfairly enforced, and an infotainment industry which has run amok for many decades by glorifying crime, gang membership, and violence. Certainly the U.S. has the highest gun ownership in the world. Something like 40% of homes have guns, and for every American there are 1.2 guns in circulation in the United States. So if anything, it's surprising that there aren't more gun deaths, intentional gun deaths. But in terms of what causes these outbreaks, these people to go, as we used to call it, postal, I come back to the core issues, which are social injustice, disenfranchisement, unfair laws that are biased and unfairly enforced.
U.S. lawmakers probing the 2021 attack on the Capitol have voted to subpoena former President Donald Trump to testify on his involvement in the riots.
So this afternoon, I am offering this resolution that the committee direct the chairman to issue a subpoena for relevant documents and testimony under oath from Donald John Trump in connection with the January 6th attack on the United States Capitol. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I yield back.
Gentlelady yields back. If there's no further debate, the question is on agreeing to the resolution. Those in favor will say aye.
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 Those opposed is no. In the opinion of the chair, the ayes have it.
Mr. Chairman, on this vote, there are 9 ayes and 0 noes.
The resolution is agreed to.
The committee chairman doubled down on the need for the former president to answer to the American people for his actions. But Trump has dismissed the subpoena, questioning the committee's long delay in asking him to testify. Republicans are expected to gain control of the House of Representatives in November. If that happens, they will immediately end the investigation, and any subpoena would expire in any case with a new congressional term in January. The subpoena is expected within days. It is widely speculated that Trump will not comply, and that could lead to charges of contempt of Congress and criminal prosecution. NATO defense ministers pledged to send advanced weapons to Ukraine until such time as Kiev wins its war against Russia. Peace campaigners say that the only way to end the conflict is through diplomatic efforts. Sherm Hughes reports.
There was no mention of peace talks to end the conflict in Ukraine as NATO defense ministers met in Brussels on Thursday. Spain, one of 30 NATO countries, has pledged to supply Kiev with advanced air defense systems.
This comes on top of what other allies have delivered over the last few days. I thank all allies for their significant contributions, and I urge them to continue to step up.
Ukraine's defense minister, Oleksiy Reznikov, attended the meeting in Brussels. While he's in Belgium, who's running things back in Kiev? It's a question we put to one expert during an online interview.
The Americans, because the Americans said we are offering intelligence information, we are coordinating the flow of weapons, they direct the battlefield, they have satellites under the disposal of their military.
NATO says it has doubled the number of its battle groups in eastern regions of the alliance. More than 30 warships are patrolling the Baltic Sea and North Sea. Critics say this steady build-up in recent years is designed to provoke Russia and keep NATO relevant while pumping trillions into the arms industry. NATO's Article 5 states that an attack on one member of the alliance is an attack on all of its members.
The United States is absolutely committed to its Article 5 commitments, and we are committed to defending every inch of NATO's territory, if and when it comes to that.
NATO says Russia's nuclear forces are being closely monitored. The alliance confirms it's going ahead with nuclear war deterrence exercises next week, dubbed Steadfast Noon. The drills will involve nuclear-capable aircraft, but apparently will not include any live bombs. Asked if the timing is bad given heightened tensions, NATO boss Jens Stoltenberg said it would send out the wrong signal if the exercises were suddenly cancelled now. Jerome Hughes, NATO headquarters, Brussels.
Canada has imposed more sanctions against Iran over what it calls human rights violations in the country. The new sanctions target three Iranian entities and 17 individuals, including former Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif. The measures ban dealings with the sanctioned people and entities, among other things. Last week, Canada also imposed sanctions on a number of other Iranian individuals and entities, including Press TV. Ottawa has cited alleged rights violations during the recent protests in Iran. These protests broke out over in the September 16th death of a young woman called Mahsa Amini. But it soon turned into riots, and Iran has reacted to those previous bans by Canada. It has referred to crimes against Indigenous people in Canada, saying Ottawa is in no position to question other countries over human rights. Author and journalist Arnold August believes Canada follows U.S. policies when it comes to Iran and many other countries.
The Canadian government, over the last few years, with regards to many countries, but specifically with regards to Iran, they simply use the U.S. State Department and White House talking points against Iran. So that is the pretext, that is so-called repression of women in Iran. Interesting, coming from a country, Canada, a colonial settler state that is now famous throughout the world for having committed and still commits genocide against the native peoples in our country, they are in a position, a moral position, to judge Iran with regards to the question of human rights. I mean, it is basically a regime change effort pushed forward by the United States, and Canada, unfortunately, as a very close and faithful ally of the United States, is following through on it by adding these sanctions.
And now with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Congratulations to all our IRIB listeners on the occasion of 17th of Rabi al-Awwal, the birth anniversary of the Prophet of Islam, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Today is in fact a day of double celebration. We celebrate the birth anniversary of the sixth infallible successor of the Holy Prophet of Islam, Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace be upon him. Congratulations to all our Muslim listeners on this very auspicious occasion.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All Compassionate, the All Merciful. Salam and welcome to another episode of our weekly series titled Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, that was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Today we complete explanation of Surah Mujadila, or the Pleader, which is number 58 in the serial order of compilation of the Noble Quran. It was revealed in Medina and mentions the complaint of a woman whose husband had put her away by resorting to the pagan Arab formula known as Zahar, which consists of the words, "You are to me as the back of my mother." This was a pagan custom to imply a kind of divorce that freed the husband from any responsibility for conjugal duties as well as providing support for children, and without allowing the wife the freedom to leave the husband's home or to contract a second marriage. The woman, who along with her husband had become a Muslim, pleaded to the Prophet against this unjust behavior and said she also lacked the means to support her little children. Her prayer to Allah and her plea was accepted, and this brutal and unjust custom of the pagan Arabs was abolished through revelation of this surah, which goes on to state that those who oppose God and the Prophet or fall to the temptations of the Satan or lie in their oaths and make intrigues against the Prophet will be defeated and suffer humiliation both in this world and in the hereafter. While Hezbollah, or the party of Allah, which means those who have firm faith in God, will triumph. We start from where we left you last Friday in our last episode of this series, and here are ayahs 18 and 19 of the said surah.
يوم يبعثهم الله جميعا فيحلفون له كما يحلفون لكم ويحسبون أنهم على شيء ألا إنهم هم الكاذبون استحوذ عليهم الشيطان فأنساهم ذكر الله أولئك حزب الشيطان ألا إن حزب الشيطان هم الخاسرون.
The day when Allah will raise them all together, they will swear to Him, just like they swear to you, O Prophet, supposing that they stand on something. Look, they are indeed liars. Satan has prevailed upon them, so he has caused them to forget the remembrance of Allah. They are Satan's confederates. Look, indeed it is Satan's confederates who are the losers. If you might recall, in our explanation of the previous ayahs of this surah last week, we said the stratagem of the hypocrites is to undermine Islam by claiming to be Muslim, in order to prevent the proper promotion in society of God's commandments. Of course, this is nothing but foolishness on the part of the hypocrites to think of themselves as clever and smart when their end is utter humiliation, both in the transient life of this world and in the hereafter. An important point to note is that wealth, power, and children may be of help in the world, but will be of no avail in the hereafter. The ayahs that we recited to you now mean to say that the hypocrites resort to false oaths both while alive in this world and also when resurrected to life after death in the hereafter. Hypocrites are mistaken to think that they can save themselves from divine punishment through lying, since lying has turned into a natural disposition for them. The day of resurrection is the scene of manifestation of deeds and intentions, and even on this day, when shown their evil deeds at the final tribunal, the hypocrites will falsely swear in the same manner that they used to swear false oaths in the transient life of the mortal world. The next ayah says the hypocrites have allowed Satan to completely dominate them to the extent they have forgotten God Almighty and His blessings. They have become the confederates or party of the Satan whose deception has totally absorbed them. In other words, the more a person drifts away from God, the more he or she is entrapped by Satan. From these ayahs, we learn that, number one, whoever heeds the temptations of the Satan will become a member of his party and thus become a loser in both the transient life of the mortal world and on the day of resurrection, where nothing can save him or her. And number two, if a person becomes a habitual liar, this habit of lying will continue even after resurrection on the day of judgment. Now let us listen to ayahs 20 and 21 of the same surah.
إن الذين يحادون الله ورسوله أولئك في الأذلين كتب الله لأغلبن أنا ورسلي إن الله قوي عزيز.
Indeed, those who oppose Allah and His Prophet, they will be among the most abased. Allah has ordained, surely I and my prophets will prevail. Indeed, Allah is all strong, almighty. Here it is stressed that the hypocrites and the disbelievers are the most abased people since they disobey the Almighty Creator's commands and ridicule the prophets. As Ayah 21 means to say, such persons will never succeed, and victory belongs solely to God and His prophets, even if the enemies happen to temporarily silence the voice of the messengers of God through imprisonment and murder. These ayahs teach us that, number one, disbelief, denial of truth, and hypocrisy leads to self-destruction and permanent loss in afterlife. Number two, those who oppose the manifest truth are the most abased persons. And number three, the divine promise on the final triumph of truth over falsehood will materialize in the end times with the advent of the awaited savior of mankind, Imam Mahdi. May God hasten his reappearance for establishment of the global government of peace, prosperity, and justice. At the end of this week's episode of Path Towards Enlightenment, we complete explanation of Surah Mujadila. And here is the last ayah, that is 22, in which God Almighty says,
لا تجد قوما يؤمنون بالله واليوم الآخر يوادون من حاد الله ورسوله ولو كانوا آباءهم أو أبناءهم أو إخوانهم أو عشيرتهم أولئك كتب في قلوبهم الإيمان وأيدهم بروح منه ويدخلهم جنات تجري من تحتها الأنهار خالدين فيها رضي الله عنهم ورضوا عنه أولئك حزب الله أَلَا إِنَّ حِزْبَ اللَّهِ هُمُ الْمُفْلِحُونَ
You will not find a people believing in Allah and the last day endearing those who oppose Allah and His Prophet, even though they were their own parents or children or brothers or kinsfolk. For such, He has written faith in their hearts and strengthened them with a spirit from Him, and He will admit them into gardens with streams running in them, to remain in them forever. Allah is pleased with them, and they are pleased with Him. They are Hezbollah. Look, indeed the party of Allah is the felicitous. This ayah refers to a general principle, that is the obedience to God Almighty through devotion to the prophets, imams, and saintly people, while firmly opposing the enemies of humanity. In other words, love for God and love for the enemies of humanity cannot be intermixed or assembled in one heart, even if the disbelievers happen to be the nearest of kin and blood relatives of the believers, such as parents, children, brothers, or sisters. Thus, God considers true believers whose hearts are purified with obedience solely for Him through devotion to the teachings of the prophets, imams, and saintly persons as Hezbollah or party of Allah. Such people are ensured of success in the world and in the hereafter through divine assistance, which becomes more manifest in the bliss of paradise where lush gardens and fresh flowing streams are granted to them. This ayah teaches us the following points. Number one, true faith requires obedience to God through devotion to the teachings of the prophets, imams, and saintly persons, while fully disavowing the disbelievers, even if they happen to be the nearest of kin. Number two, love and affection of the faithful and the faithless cannot exist in one single heart, which ought to be purified of all filth in order to gain the belief. And number three, in Islam, the bonds of faith are superior to family, tribal, and even national attachments.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The spotlight.
an Israeli soldier was killed in Al-Quds. This occurred after four Palestinians were shot dead in an Israeli raid in the occupied West Bank. Now, whether these incidents are related remains to be seen, but at this point it shows that when a Palestinian wants to act against Israeli forces, it can do so, aside from this being a reaction due to Israeli repression. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at why the Israeli-Palestinian conflict remains at the heart of the decades-old conflict in West Asia and how Israel continues its flagrant violations of Palestinians. First, let's cross on over to occupied Ramallah and talk to Mona Kandil about what has occurred. Mona, at this point, tell us the numbers that have been injured, both on the Palestinian side or killed, and also on the Israeli side, and where things stand at this point.
Well, we have to mention that the manhunt for the Palestinian man, or the suspect, Israeli state, who's behind the shooting, is still underway. Yesterday, a Palestinian get out of a vehicle at a military checkpoint at the entrance to Shafat refugee camp in Al-Quds and opened fire at the Israeli soldiers stationing there, killing an Israeli female soldier and wounding others. At least two are in serious condition. The Israelis claimed that the man the identity of the man was revealed from the Shafat refugee camp. The Israeli soldiers succeeded, unfortunately, to arrest four Palestinians. One of them is the brother of this man who carried out the shooting, as the Israeli military is saying. Both, all the four Palestinians who were arrested denied any information. They say that they didn't know that the man would be carrying out a shooting. They said that they stopped the vehicle at the checkpoint. He get out of the vehicle and opened fire. All the entrances, we have to say, leading to Shafat refugee camp were completely closed by the Israeli forces. More Israeli soldiers were sent there. Clashes have taken place between Palestinian residents of the Shafat refugee camp as well as the residents of Anata, the nearby Palestinian town, with the Israeli soldiers. Up till the moment, the manhunt is underway and the entrances to Shafat refugee camp and Anata town are completely closed. A number of Palestinian groups said that they are responsible for the shooting, but at the same time, experts and the Israeli military believe that this man carried out the shooting by himself, and they know that he was not affiliated to any of the Palestinian resistance groups.
Thank you very much for that. We appreciate it. Mona Kandil there from Occupied Ramallah. Thank you.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Now let me introduce our guest for this edition of the program. Moti Abu Musaba is a Palestinian political activist that joins us from Gaza City. Also joining us is Mick Napier, Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign, who joins us from Edinburgh. Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Let me first get an idea from you, Mick Napier, about what has occurred. I mean, we're looking at a brazen attack, the person who decided to do this, which is said to be a revenge attack. It's almost confirmed. Our correspondent also confirmed that, where an Israeli soldier was killed. The fact that this person took matters into his hands and went out and did this obviously is one side of the story. But the reasons as to why this has occurred is where we'd like to get a reaction from you on this.
Well, reasons work at several different levels. Now, when we talk about a revenge attack, Israel has been on a killing spree, and it believes that it can kill. It's been young teenagers recently they've been focusing on, quite a few of them children. But Israel believes that it can kill these Palestinians with relative impunity in the West Bank, because they have saturated the area with soldiers, with the world's most advanced surveillance equipment. And therefore they think that the Palestinians are, to use the disgusting language of an earlier Israeli general, are like drugged cockroaches in a bottle, which is what they thought they could reduce the Palestinians to. But they're not drugged and they're not cockroaches. And it's very difficult for the Israelis to cope with the kind of resistance which we've just seen, where a heroic young man, possibly not connected to any other resistance groups, but certainly, I would imagine, influenced by the current developments and changes in tactics of those resistance groups, the resurgence, not just in Jenin, but spilling over into other areas in the West Bank. He couldn't help but be lifted by this. And the fact that he's been able, nonchalantly, you would almost imagine that he was trained militarily, but that he could emerge from a car and inflict such damage on this massively highly equipped army, which has been terrorizing the West Bank successfully to a degree for a very long time, is quite remarkable. Quite remarkable. And you have to explain it, not just in terms of whether he himself has suffered family members killed or brutalization. This is the small change of life in the West Bank. But whether he feels that the alternative is simply doom, not just for him personally, but for the Palestinian people. Because the Israelis make no secret that their plan is a Palestine without Palestinians. And therefore, given the lack of any alternative to resistance other than humiliation and degradation, increasing numbers of people are choosing the route of armed resistance. How that will go, it's impossible from my armchair to predict, but it's certainly a devastating surprise for the Israelis that Palestinians, after everything they've been through, still resist, and so successfully.
The point that our guest there from Edinburgh makes, Moti Abu Musaba, is a very important one, I think. And I'm wondering what you think about that, and that is the fact that you have somebody that is not related to any particular resistance group, but is a lone person who has decided to react based on the fact that Israel has killed Palestinians and carried out the operation. And that's quite remarkable, because many are now subscribing to that method. Do you think that this is something that is going to keep on increasing as time goes by?
Yes, first of all, thanks for having me. It's my pleasure to join you once again. In fact, there is, I think, a wide consensus that the resistance actions against the Israeli occupation and the recent days actually are remarkably increasing. And in my opinion, there are many, there are multiple reasons behind that. The first one is the ongoing and the relentless Israeli suppression and aggression practice against the Palestinians in the West Bank. Today, as you know, the bloodshedding of the Palestinians there is continued since the beginning of this year, as you have mentioned, that since the beginning of this year, 2022, more than 100 Palestinians were killed and murdered by the Israeli occupation in front of the whole world. Needless to mention, the ongoing raids and the continuous storming of Palestinian cities and villages in the West Bank, especially in Nablus and Jenin City, actually this goes hand in hand with the deteriorating situation of the economic conditions and the humanitarian conditions. According to the latest records, the unemployment rate actually surpasses 70% among the Palestinian youths there. So this actually ignites the tension on the West Bank. Actually, let's be clear that on the other hand, beside that or in addition to that, Israel deliberately tries to build more and more settlements. Israel tries to create a new de facto on the ground.
There is some important and an important issue and important reason behind that, which is the ongoing Israeli violations practiced in Al-Aqsa Yards, which actually, as you know, adds fuel to the fire in the West Bank, because the Palestinian people there are watching the Israeli provocations against the Palestinian citizens, against the Palestinian women, and elderly there, which actually adds fuel to the fire and increase the tension among those yachts. So, amid all those provocations, amid all those attacks and aggressions, the Palestinian people have no choice but to resist the Israeli occupation and to defend themselves.
Indeed, those are some very good points that you make in terms of the right to react there. But, you know, what is somewhat interesting here is how the interpretation is made, McNabb, here, when it comes to the way Israel describes the situation. In this case, in point, the Israeli military says that it opens fire only when it's in life-threatening situations. That kind of brings back the explanation given during the last war, where you have the U.S. and the EU come out and say Israel has the right to defend itself. Isn't that code for Israel to shoot and kill?
Of course. And not only will the green light be shown from Washington or Berlin or London, but they will also supply the means for the killing. Look, Israel is very adept at propaganda. It doesn't seem to work with the great majority of people in Europe, actually, but they're still very adept at it. Israel has been caught officers killing children. I myself spoke to the father of a 13-year-old schoolgirl, quite famous was the case, Iman al-Hams, because of an accident recording the soldiers talking. And the officer told his soldiers to kill anything in the area, even if it was 3 years old. And that was played on Israeli television. I was looking through some old anniversaries yesterday and came upon the example. It's quite shocked. I was shocked, but I don't know why, of the Israeli general who found a group of Egyptians during one of the wars, and they were captives, they were quarry workers, they were not soldiers, they were completely unarmed. And the story is not that he killed all of them, he did, he slaughtered these civilians, but that much later he boasted about it in Israeli media, and there was no backlash, there were no charges, no investigation. So if you murder civilians, Egyptian or Palestinian, Lebanese or whatever, and then boast about what you have done in Israel, you can do this with complete impunity. So the Americans have an intelligence agency, so do the British. It's not that they don't know. They know exactly the barbarity of the Israelis. They know this because they've studied it. And for a very short time, the British were on the receiving end of it, very short before they restructured the alliance. So they know exactly what Israel's doing in terms of killing children, deliberately killing children. There have been UN reports in the last couple of years which say very clearly Israel is indiscriminately killing civilians in Gaza at that time and is indiscriminately killing children. During the Great March of Return, the UN reported that Israel was killing journalists, medical workers, and children. And it said, knowing that they were children and knowing who they were. So there's no secret. You don't have to be a radical or a dissident. Anybody who wants to find out can find this out from unimpeachable resources. Sure. What the Palestinians live under is a most barbaric and murderous regime. And that explains one thing. People under colonial domination, the naked violence, let's say, which what colonialism is, many people just try to live, you know. They don't want to fight. There's a minority who want to fight. There's a minority who want to collaborate always. But most people in the middle just try to feed their families and live and put up with some humiliation. But they begin to resist in the mass when they realize that they cannot live in this way, that the Israelis will not allow them to live in this way, that the humiliation and the killings will be incessant and will increase until Palestinians are driven out. So we can look at the tactics of the resistance. They're very impressive. They're changing in a way that they've evolved tactics, which are keeping the Israelis wrong-footed. But the rising resistance can be laid at the door, one, of the Israelis, and two, of the indomitable Palestinian ability to absorb tremendous punishment and still continue to resist. Can I just add one thing?
Go ahead.
100 Palestinians killed, and they've managed to kill, I think, 19 or 20 Israelis. Now, that's horrible, and I don't want to sound callous. But, you know, normally in an anti-colonial resistance, it can be 100-1. In Vietnam, it was 60-1. You know, in Algeria, it was roughly 100 Algerians killed for every French occupier. So what the Palestinian resistance is achieving at very high cost, I don't want to minimize the cost, is quite remarkable.
Yeah, you both have talked about this figure, which is accurate in terms of 100 being killed. And what is really, really sad about this figure, that this is five times as many Palestinians that have been killed in the same period in 2021, where we mentioned 100. So bad that the UN Human Rights Chief, Michel Bachelet, has expressed alarm at the high number of Palestinians, including children, that have been killed and or injured in the occupied Palestinian territory this year. Muti Abu Musabe, why do you think that Israel has put his killing machine, as some call it, in high gear this year?
Yes, as you know, that the Israeli occupation forces are trying to impose a new de facto on the ground. They are racing counter the clock to impose the new realities on the ground, to seize more Palestinian lands, armed with the open American support and the abhorrent silence of the international community towards those crimes. So Israel, as good as possible, tries to suppress more Palestinians, to steal more Palestinian lands, trying to exploit the tumultuous region and the instability and the global fronts, especially with regard to the Ukrainian and Russian crisis nowadays. But anyway, as you know, that Palestinians would never allow the Israelis the Israeli occupation to keep committing its crimes without any punishment or without any response. And actually, what is going on the ground with this regard actually reveals the hypocrisy of the international community and the U.S. administration that speaks up when it comes to the Ukrainian issue, when it comes to the Ukrainian regions annexed by the Russian forces and the Russian government. They are speaking up and trying to denounce that kind of annexation. But when it comes to the Palestinian people, we are witnessing how the Israeli occupation forces are annexing the Palestinian or have been annexing the Palestinian lands for more than seven decades without having any response from the international community or the U.S. administration. Actually, this reveals clearly how hypocrite and how biased the international community to the Israeli occupation at the expense of the Palestinian people. Today, the Palestinian people, amid all that kind of bias, have no choice but to resist the Israeli occupation and to prevent the Israeli occupation from committing its crimes.
Well, this is the problem here, McNabb, here, that I see it being a problem of perception, that the Israelis, backed by their media conglomerates that they control, always paint the picture that they are being the victim. For example, if you have a Palestinian that attacks them, that Palestinian is called a terrorist. But when you have one of their security sources or forces, kill a Palestinian, then they're defending Israel's security. Our guests have talked about the Ukraine conflict. Again, a matter of perception. Who's being the aggressor there? Is Russia being the aggressor, or are they being the ones that were being provoked and being cornered after 6 years of a war, for example? And I'm using that just as a comparative analysis there. This view of the perception is what we're looking at. But do you think slowly but surely Israel is losing that battle because so many people are becoming aware of the Palestinian cause?
No, I don't think that Israel is slowly losing the battle. I don't think so at all. I think if you study the numbers, polls commissioned by the European Union, recent polls in America, for that matter, in the last few weeks, Israel long ago lost the battle for public opinion. And it's very important to note that. It's not what I want to believe. It's what anybody who looks at the at the results of public opinion studies must conclude that by their resistance, Palestinians have been able to defeat Israel in the court of public opinion. Now, I don't mean in terms of what's allowed to be discussed publicly in Britain or Germany or America. That's a different matter. I have spent years in court on criminal charges for Palestine advocacy. There's an attempt to silence people here, just as there is to call human rights groups in the West Bank terrorist groups. Israel does it there. Our governments do it here. But in terms of what people believe, they already are deeply suspicious of Israel. And opinion poll after opinion poll shows that Israel is deeply unpopular, viewed as sinister, viewed as a thug and a bully by popular opinion. Now, that needs to be translated into active energy, boycott, divestment and sanctions around the world. But that's the reality we start with. So I don't think Israel's slowly losing it. It's very important to understand they lost it a long time ago and they have never recovered public support. It's gone. It's gone completely.
Okay. We need to talk about the Islamic Jihad. They actually have supported what has happened because of the bravery of the person that came out and did this. So my question to you, Muti Abu Musab, it was just the founding anniversary that was held a few days back in Gaza by the Islamic Jihad. And on display were some new military equipment and some other various forms of military equipment in addition to the new ones. Are we looking at Israel taking note of the Islamic Jihad, its strength that's been elevated, increased compared to the past, including other resistance groups like Hamas, and seeing that, you know, they are not at a strong point when it comes to the armed aspect, when it comes to, for example, resistance groups vis-a-vis Israel and their forces?
Yes, as you know that today the Palestinian resistance factions actually are standing united in the front of the Israeli occupation, and they are races counter the clock to develop their abilities and to enhance their abilities to confront the Israeli occupation crimes. Today it's just a matter of time for any kind of escalation to break out between the Palestinian resistance factions and the Israeli occupation forces, especially amid the ongoing and the relentless Israeli crimes and violations, which actually makes any kind of a new escalation or a new round of escalation is so close. Amid all these conditions, the Palestinian resistance factions, especially or led by Hamas movement and the Islamic Jihad, are obliged to be united in the front of the Israeli occupation to have a strong unity. We as Palestinians realize that we cannot face the Israeli occupation separately, okay, or divided. The strategic choice we have here is to keep maintaining our unity in front of the Israeli occupation and sure, to develop our abilities to confront the Israeli occupation forces.
Thank you for that. Sorry, we're fresh out of time. That's Mick Napier there, Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign. Thank you. Muti Abu Musab, a pleasure. Palestinian political activist from Gaza City. Thank you so much. And we had Mona Kandil at the top of the hour, our correspondent from Ramallah. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Yacoub Tahway and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio.